Good evening, everybody, and welcome. My name is Sophia, and I run events here at The Strand. Before we launch into a discussion of William Gibson's paperback release of Agency, I'd like to share a little bit of history about The Strand. The Strand was founded in 1927 by Benjamin Bass on 4th Avenue's Book Row. Stretching from Union Square to Astor Place, Book Row gradually dwindled from 48 bookstores until, after 93 years, The Strand is the sole survivor, now run by third-generation owner Nancy Bass Wyden. We want to thank all of you for all of your support. Without our loyal community of book lovers, we wouldn't be here today. Tonight, we are thrilled to have with us William Gibson for the paperback release of Agency. William Gibson lives in Vancouver, British Columbia, with his wife. He is the author of Neuromancer, Count Zero, Mona Lisa Overdrive, Burning Chrome, Virtual Light, Idoru, All Tomorrow's Parties, Pattern Recognition, Spook Country, Zero History, Distrust That Particular Flavor, and The Peripheral. Joining William in conversation is Cory Doctorow. Cory is a regular contributor to The Guardian, Locus, and many other publications. His award-winning novel, Little Brother, was a New York Times bestseller, as is its sequel, Homeland. His novella collection, Radicalized, was a CBC Best Fiction of 2019 selection. He lives with his family in Los Angeles. So, without further ado, please welcome William Gibson and Cory Doctorow to the stage.
There he is. Hi, everyone. Corey. Hi, Bill. It's really great to be here again, and great to be chatting with Bill again. I did a little math today. We had our first conversation when I interviewed him for All Tomorrow's Parties for the Globe and Mail 22 years ago in Toronto. So we've been having these conversations for a long time. Bill's latest book is Agency. It's the sequel to The Peripheral. I think it's a very important novel in Bill's canon and in the science fiction canon, in part because it merges the two Gibsonite tendencies that we know about, the first one being those groundbreaking, eyeball-kicking, super-futuristic novels that entered the field in the 1980s, like Neuromancer, and the second being the decade of books that did the audacious trick of writing near future science fiction about the recent past, the books that started with Pattern Recognition. And with The Agency, you have a book that is, and with Peripheral, you have books that are simultaneously about the current day and the far future. And the merger of those two bills, I think, makes for very exciting, spicy reading. Now, Bill, I wanted to start by asking you about Agency, because it is a book with a curious and storied history that relates to our current events and the current moment, in that you wrote a near future novel and then threw away a large portion of it and delayed it by more than a year so that you could update it for the Trump presidency that has just ended. And I wonder if you could reflect a little. I mean, I don't think you labor under the pretense that you're Nostradamus and have to get your future right. I think if anything, the near future books, you know, disabused everyone of that. But what was it about wanting to reflect those times that made you revisit the book?
Well, the books that the book called Agency was going to be, up until the morning I woke to discover that Donald Trump was president of the United States, had really been set a few years into the future. In a way, I felt like I'd assumed I was going back to what I'd done with the Big End books, and that they were written and set in the year in which they would be published, because it takes about 2 years between me and the publishing process for a book to come out. So I thought it was going to be another of those novels of the near future, and I thought that The Peripheral had, done its job. And then I woke up and dealing with my feelings and whatnot. And it took me a while to realize that the book I had been working on, which was, you know, a couple of hundred pages of manuscript, was written in a world that wasn't going to exist. Like, nothing made any sense emotionally. Nothing. I thought, no, this is such a big bad thing that's happened that it won't. This there'll be no way that the book I'm writing now can resonate when it's published. It won't be, you know, it ceased to be topical, and that made me very unhappy. And I began to consciously try to come up with other books I would like to write, or ways I could change the book that eventually became Agency. And that was, you know, that was an unhappy process. But then I realized that I kept thinking of the book I'd been writing before as taking place in an alternate time track. So and I immediately thought, what if this is a stub where this woman named Verity lives, and this is a stub where the election went the other way? And a lot of the emotional content would be preserved because it wouldn't be that world. But I didn't want it to be. I didn't want it to be like automatically like, what a great world. So I gave them problems, and you know, the problems aren't unrealistic. And as someone in Agency says, of the people living in the past who went the other way, they say, well, you know, they're still coming into the saw blade, but they're doing it at a less acute angle. They're big because there's, you know, they're really bigger problems that will continue on. And once I had that, it was, I won't say it was easy, but at least it felt right.
Yeah, it certainly, you know, felt like you were reassuring us, or rather warning us, that Trump was too dumb to be a cause and was more likely to be a symptom, and that getting rid of Trump would not get rid of our problems. Now, there's another work in this series. There's a graphic novel that's set in World War II. And I wonder whether or how that played into Agency, and whether there's more of that coming.
Well, that's the comic. It was like a limited, originally it was, you know, a limited run comic. I've never thought of it as being a part of the Agency world. It's something on its own, but it came about because, well, I knew actually someone wanted a screenplay. The thing was originally a screenplay, and Agency was very freshly done, and I was really intrigued with the, I guess I could say, novelty of the alternate world concept in that book, which wasn't mine, actually. It's from a short story by Bruce Sterling and Lou Shiner, called Mozart and Mirror Shades. And it differs from the usual time travel alternate reality butterfly effect in that you can contact, you could contact the past, but only digitally. But when you contact it digitally, when they receive their first, whoever receives the first email from 150 years in the future, they split. Like it creates an entirely new universe. And there's assumed to be like, you know, a potentially infinite number of these. So the world you email to is what your world was like up until the moment that email arrived, and then it causes this split. So it does away with all of the, to my taste anyway, tedious paradox massaging that tends to take place in time travel stories. No one, you know, the people in the future have to worry about what they're going to do to their world, because it can't possibly affect them. And this causes quite a few of them to have a very cavalier attitude toward those alternate tracks and their inhabitants. Others, the opposite. And so anyway, I had that bouncing around, and someone asked me for a screenplay. It was actually a screenplay that my friend Michael St. John Smith was his, the guy who asked him, the producer who asked him, it was going to be German television. And so Mike said, was telling me about it, and I started blabbering about Stubbs and what it would be like. And so eventually it became one of those things where we were spending too much time talking about it, so we just wrote it. But I've never thought of it as part of the peripheral universe, but by the time we finished it, it was finished before Trump's election, long before Trump's election, and no one wanted to make a film of it. So, as frequently happens with screenplays, so someone asked me, you know, to do a comic, and I said, well, here's it, look, read this. And they said, that's great. But we were able to change the very end of it then to fit the alternate reality of the Trump era. So it winds up with one of the good guys in our dystopia. seeing a newspaper with Trump's picture.
Yeah, I loved that little grace note. Speaking of Trump, one of the things that I've asked you about at punctuated intervals for 22 years now is your relationship to subculture and how you made hackers cool in the 1980s, and how coolness and subculture and a complicated relationship with it goes through Case Pollard. And certainly, you know, by the time we get to the world of the peripheral, you have these far future worlds where you have whole neighborhoods where people are LARPing 24/7. And in the contemporary world, you have all these other subcultures, including these kind of Oakley shade Punisher logo subcultures. And it struck me as fitting and terrifying that the end of the Trump era that caused the delay to the agency publication was marked by an eruption of multiple subcultures, Boogaloo Boys, QAnon cultists, and so on. And they're not cool subcultures, but they're like really important subcultures, probably more salient than like punk ever was in terms of the impact that they're going to have on our society. And I wondered where your head was at as this keen observer of the complexity of subculture and its commodification, as you watch these cultists perform these bizarre, dangerous stunts.
Well, I'd say the thing that's been most consistently obvious to me about that is that without the web, without the internet, they would have no place to perform the stunts. Their existence is a result of the, paradoxically, the democratization of media in over the past 20 to 30 years. So it's the Proud Boys are operating really in the same landscape as teen influencers. It's just some teen influencers making millions and millions of dollars per year. So that's the thing that's always been most evident for me.
So there's always been a kind of Afrofuturist vein in your work, you know, whether it's the Space Rastas in the Neuromancer books and all the way forward. And Agency really kind of digs into, again, some of the uncomfortable and also amazing valences of Afrofuturism. You have this artificial intelligence who's a U.S. Army veteran who's been reincarnated without her permission as a rogue AI. And Adriana in the chat and on Twitter, she's been adding us pretty often, asking to what extent this is a horror novel about being a black person trapped in a machine for all time against your wishes. And it made me think of Jordan Poole's Get Out and this idea that technology and blackness have their own complicated and multi-directional relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree. I think I would agree with that. I don't actually think that. I mean, I would, when on those rare occasions. Well, I have to say, increasingly less rare. To my dismay, occasions where I tried to consider what the real future, what our actual future might actually be like. I don't think of having highly evolved AI or simulacra of actual historical humans, and it still seems quite far fetched and fairy tale like to me. But for the sake of, there's something about that I've come back to through my whole career to date, and I'm not exactly sure what it is. I think one thing it does is it gives me a chance to approach the question of what humans are in a way that I couldn't do if I were merely working with human characters.
Mm-hmm.
So, the thing I wonder about with and I'm wondering about it in terms of the book I'm writing now, is that if Eunices, or for that matter, Lobeers, actually existed and were, effectively immortal and had this kind of behind-the-scenes world-changing powers that they do in my books, what would that do to democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if you actually had a genuinely benign AI watching over us? So that, you know, of course, gives you the willies too. So, and I think I've always shied away from that. And with this book I'm writing now, I sort of get closer to maybe have a bit franker look at that.
Yeah, I'm struck by the frequency with which AI is a MacGuffin in the Gibson canon. You know, one of my favorite characters is Dixie Flatline, and not just for his eternal line that I've quoted so many times, "Don't let the little fuckers generation gap you," but also because as someone who's being simulated in software, his last request to his protege is erase me. Mm-hmm. And here we are in, you know, this modern world in the 21st century where there's a lot of grifters who claim that they've got AI. You know, they've done some statistical inference stuff and they've called it AI and promising that cars will drive themselves. We also have, at the same time, you know, what Charlie Strauss calls the slow AIs, that companies are like remorseless, self-running colony organisms that use human beings as gut flora. And that you know, enact themselves without their leaders really having any ability to steer them. They're just sort of agents in a multi-agent simulation who have to just go about their business. And you know, finally we have this revisiting of the socialist calculation debate from the 1920s when, you know, the fathers of modern neoliberalism argued that you could never compute an economy. It's just too big. And now you have the fully automated luxury communist movement saying, actually, we could totally compute the economy and it would do away with markets. So where are you at on AIs now, Bill?
Well, I've never really been anywhere anywhere that I've understood myself with AIs. The thing that's always drawn them to me is they allow me to ask, you know, even just myself sometimes, not necessarily the reader, questions about what it is to be human that I don't think I could find the place to ask the question without having them. And I have a kind of, I've scarcely ever used Siri for anything. The only thing I've avoided more perfectly than using Siri is joining Facebook.
I knew you were going to say that. Zucker vegans represent.
Yeah. So I never wanted to do Facebook at all. When I was an undergraduate at UBC, I had a couple of experiences there. One was seeing La Jetée for the first time in a proper screening room. I mean, I'd never seen it at all, but I got to see it on a theater screen, and just being completely blown away, and it somehow restored my faith in science fiction.
Hmm.
Really profoundly. I mean, I'd been a big science fiction fan in my mid-teens, and then the 60s counterculture set had come along, and I had seen science fiction starting to go with the countercultures I was attracted to, or starting to emerge from various versions of that. So I didn't know, you know, when I was 14, I didn't really know anything about contemporary London except that, lots of the British New Wave writers I particularly like lived in Ladbroke Grove. I knew, you know, I knew that. And so, but then I got kind of swept away from science fiction into the 60s and didn't think to go back and look at it until the, you know, the 60s tsunami had kind of settled a bit. And I was incredibly disappointed with it.
Hmm.
Because it was like the all the SF writers who signed in favor of the Vietnam War in the New York Times, it was like they won. Like that was still looked like the mainstream of SF to me. And there were some cool people writing and some cool stuff being written. But it made me unhappy. Then when I started to, you know, to vaguely approach the idea of writing SF, I was reading contemporary fiction of science fiction of the early 80s and you know, going, oh no, this isn't working for me. So when I came back, I tried to, you know, get into it myself, and it felt like a kind of homecoming. To some extent, I wanted to do something that would be like a contemporary 80s version of what I had seen the British New Wave writers and writers like Samuel Delaney do when I'd been 14 or 15 years old.
Yeah.
And I wasn't finding that. I was sort of finding more of it in more of that in the pages of the American edition of Heavy Metal than I was finding it on the, you know, science fiction on the book racks.
Yeah. Gosh, there's so much I want to ask you about. I want to come back to that, and I specifically, so maybe you can think ahead about it, I want to ask you about how Judy Merrill fits into that whole story. But before we go to Judy, who I think may be a linchpin there, I want to ask you, you know, I asked you about AIs, and you talked about them as standing in for people, but your AIs aren't just AIs, they're rogue AIs, right? All of your AIs are rogue AIs. And the MacGuffin of the peripheral is this like unknowable technology, right? It's like it's a thing on the internet. No one knows who made it. No one knows how it works. No one even has a good theory. And this is not in our benighted world. This is in the far future where they have, you know, actual like super amazing post-futuristic technology stuff, and still no one knows how it works. And it seems to me that there's a connection between a rogue AI and the great themes of science fiction going back to Frankenstein and the gateway, right? And that, and I wonder, like, what does this say about you say you're attuned to the poetics of technology. That's my favorite line from you about your work. What is the poetic of technology when it comes to technology out of control, to the rogue AI, the mysterious gateway?
Well, I've done it. I think I've come at that in the course of my career. I've come at that in a number of different ways, but they're not. It's like when I'm really writing, I'm really writing something that most people will assume is science fiction, that most people would recognize as science fiction. I'm asking questions, and I'm not really answering them. And I don't do much answering of questions. So I think the first thing that I did with AI after having written Neuromancer, Neuromancer to me is a strange artifact because I didn't know how to write a novel. So there are things about how it's shaped and how it operates today that strike me as just being like incredibly weird. But then I think about it and I realize that it was just, that was the only way I could figure out to make the thing, to make the thing operate and to get through it. And it's not even a very long, it's like a very long novella, more than a novel. But I had hit on this thing where I could get very interested in this kind of AI I was making up, and you wind up in the two subsequent books in what became that trilogy with the AI. One of the AIs that you first met in Neuromancer spends all its time in an abandoned space station making Joseph Cornell-like collage sculptures out of all of this, you know, Howard Hughesian massive junk that's drifting there in zero gravity. But I don't think, for me, it doesn't, I guess it says something about AI, but I couldn't tell you what I think it means. Like it's for me, what I'm doing when I write this stuff is putting out, you know, I'm assembling these enigmatic, hope sometimes rather poetic objects that will trigger questions in other people, but they're almost never questions that I myself could answer at all. And I may never answer them to, you know, not even to my own satisfaction. I think I probably got that from the new wave SF writers, that they weren't telling me, how things worked and telling me what I should think about things. They were closer to Joseph Cornell than John W. Campbell said.
I love that. I want to mention as a kind of a nota bene that your neighbor George Dyson had a book out last summer called Analogia, which is about technology overtaking our ability to understand it. And George is Freeman Dyson's son, grew up in the Princeton Institute, where the kids didn't go to summer camp. They got locked in the basement to hand wind the cores for the first computers. And alongside Gödel's kids and so on. So it's quite a remarkable story. It spans everything from sea kayaks to modern computing. It's very good. Yeah. I did want to ask you about Judith Merril, because, you know, she is the doyenne of Canadian science fiction and the new wave. I think you knew her in your Toronto days. I certainly was mentored by her. And I wonder where Judy fits into all of this. She was a feminist writer, critic, and editor who divorced Frederick Pohl and went into voluntary exile after the Chicago police riots in '68 in Canada.
Well, I never met her in my Toronto days. In fact, I don't even think I didn't know that she was there.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. I had no contact with, from the time I arrived in Toronto in, I think, March of 1967 to when I was living in, you know, first living in Vancouver like a decade later, I had no contact with, you know, no contact with the science fiction subculture, and I wasn't reading SF. So it was just a different world. It was like there was no internet. And I probably had thought of her for a long time, but as I began to try to write SF, which gave me a sense of my own, you know, sort of renewed my sense of my own history with it, I realized that she had been a phenomenally strong influence on my sense of what science fiction was, because she published this absolutely superb annual collection, like her, you know, what she chose to be the year's best science fiction as short fiction. And she had absolutely no regard for the supposed boundaries of the genre. So you could have Fritz Lieber on one page and Julio Cortazar on the next. And so I was, she exposed all of her readers to this fantastically sophisticated way of looking at what science fiction was.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's
so my dad used to sit me down with him on the nights my mom was at teacher's college to watch Judy introduce Doctor Who on public television. And he said, that's my friend I know from socialist organizing circles. And then when I was 9, I went on a school trip to the library that she founded, which is now called the Merrill Collection, was then called the Spaced Out Library. And she invited us to bring her our manuscripts. And wow. And from that age, I was bringing her manuscripts. I'd get on the subway and go down to Spadina and Bloor and bring her manuscripts for critique. Wow. And then she put me in the writing group with Carl Schrader and Peter Watts and all those other writers. I mean, she was really a force of nature. Really remarkable.
Yeah, she was indeed. I met her subsequently, you know.
Right.
So I got to actually meet her a couple of times, and she was a force of nature that way as well. But the impact that her editorial sense had on you know, my personal sense of what science fiction can be, it's just enormous.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you finally, we're getting close to Q&A. I assume that we're starting the Q&A about 12 minutes late because we started the event about 12 minutes late. I did want to ask you about this third book. Is this a third peripheral book?
Yes, it is. And,
do you have to rewrite it for the Biden presidency?
Oh, I hope not. I'm thinking, you know, I probably won't. As soon as, well, it wasn't soon enough for me, but once it became apparent that Biden was going to be president, the one area in which I didn't feel an immediate relief was, you know, that my sense of where the plot of this book might go, because both the peripheral and agency sort of have, I think, really, you know, subtle ways of cheating their way around, like, the characters in, you know, 150 years in the future in London know what happened, and they are our future. They know what happened, but so happens through the course of these two books, none of them have ever happened to think about it or articulate it to anyone. So if you asked Inspector Ainsley Lobeer, if say Verity from Agency were to ask Lobeer what happened in this terrifying world where Donald Trump won, because that didn't happen in her world, Lobeer could just tell her. Just run it, you know, and then he got in for a second term, and that's how we wound up with the military coup that is peripherally mentioned in the peripheral. But And it would have been easier. It would have been easier to work with that material. Now I have to work with, well, I don't know exactly. And, like, there's a female president in American president in the peripheral, and we know she's the first, but we don't know her number because we don't know the exact, you know, is she like 47, you know, or like is she maybe 48? Could she be 50? President 50? And I've, you know, never wanted to work it out because it cramps my style. But I think with the way things are going now, I've got more wiggle room in the book in terms of that timeline. I mean, eventually, as happens to all science fiction written in imaginary futures, the things will start to obsolete. I mean, I've said it before, but science, you know, future predictive science fiction is like, you know, they're like ice cream cones. They start melting the minute you write them down, and by the time people get them home, they're just completed. And ultimately, they're only about the moment in which they were written. And that's what makes them really interesting. Even now, like the 19th century SF, it's like a wonderful kind of window into the time in which it was written. And that's what ours will ultimately be.
Yeah. I spent the weekend rereading an old H.G. Wells essay collection because Bruce Sterling's written an afterword to it, and they asked me for a blurb. And I know exactly what you mean. It's a remarkable experience. So I want to get into some of the questions from our audience here, and I'm going to take some liberties with them. Gardner asked about researching tech, clothing, and gear. I'm just interested generically in your clothing fascination, where it's going. You I think, go deeper on the question of odd clothing design than is justified by your books, and it indicates a kind of genuine passion. It's not just, you're not just doing research, like you're hooked. And I want to know what you're hooked by.
Well, I'm nerding out, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just, you know, at some point in, I guess in pattern recognition, I just like decided to nerd out, but then I'll nerd out on clothing. But then in Altamont parties, it was vintage watches. But I think when when I was 14 or 15 years old, around the time that I was, you know, I was discovering a lot of things. I was discovering the history of the world as related mostly by Walter Cronkite, which, you know, actually isn't a bad place to start. I was reading science fiction and having, without realizing it, kind of an eye for what science fiction was more sophisticated in terms of how the world really was, but also reading men's magazines. And I was one of the guys who actually did read the articles in Playboy. But I actually suspect that there were an awful lot of young men my age who read the articles in Playboy, because Hefner's taste in prose and what was interesting could really be extraordinarily good, or at least to the editors he hired could be really good. And while I was doing that, I was getting deluged by on this advertising for men's clothing. And I think without sort of formally thinking of it, I began trying to understand the world around me by this language and culture of clothing people, the clothing that people in it wore. And I'd see that, okay, they're selling these guys this. What is it? And how does that relate to what the people around me were wearing at the time? And so I very early saw it as a kind of language. And one in which, you know, lots of people are extremely fluent, probably without even thinking about thinking that they are. Like, people read clothing. It's sort of, aside from, like, it covers you up and keeps you warm, but it may, you know, it spends an awful lot of time saying things. And I got a sense of that very early. And I remember really being struck by the first counterculture people I actually saw. It had been when I was in a boys' boarding school in Tucson. And during the weekend, sometimes we'd get to go into town and could wander over by the University of Arizona. And there would see people who were hitchhiking through from California and whatnot. And it was, I was just like so kind of excited and startled to see these people wearing not only a different statement, but like a different language. There's a whole, there's like an entirely new language there. It was made up of mostly, you know, entirely traditional things that were very retro in the 60s, and that now we just think of as being atemporal. Like seeing denim jeans worn in the language of the 60s, as opposed to the various ways they'd been worn before, was, you know, an amazing thing. And so I've always been interested in that sort of thing. And I think of the technical clothing is just an extension of that for me. Hmm. It's, you know, I'm not like a wardrobe survivalist by any means.
But you were a picker, right? You made a living for a time as a thrifting nice pieces and turning them around.
Yeah, I did. Although at the time that wasn't the stuff I was trying, you know, out there to pick was never clothing. Toronto in the early 1970s, the crippled civilians stores, the big ones, which is an old, very old school charity there, had the most amazing stuff in it. Like, it was, I guess it was generational. Like, probably a lot of people who had been adults in the 1940s were dying on a regular basis. There's, you know, the natural turnover of things. And I remember once, look, something I saw and didn't even think was remarkable was a children's wading pool, that old-fashioned kind with metal sides and not very high. a children's wading pool that had been set up in the middle of this huge thrift store, and it was completely filled with laundered, pressed cellophane men's shirts from the 1940s, many of which were, you know, the kind that are made for, you know, detachable collars. And like any one of those shirts, if you had it today,
yeah,
you could put it up on eBay and you could get some serious money. People
hardcore money.
Weren't even looking at, you know, like denim sort of didn't, vintage denim didn't exist as a thing. It hadn't yet crossed what a friend of mine called the valley of no value.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a time when, you know, things aren't old enough to be really old. They just sort of have no value. The time in Toronto I'm thinking of, if you found a in very good condition, a 1930s Art Deco steel desk on the sidewalk, there was no place, even if you could like put it on roller skates and haul it away, there was no place in town that would buy it. Nobody wanted stuff like that yet. But mm-hmm. the same piece today down in, you know, Tribeca would, you know, cost about, you know, would cost you the same as a secondhand BMW.
Right.
And it's, so that sort of fascinated me. I never liked being an accumulator of things, and I don't really collect things, so I try not.
Oh, me either.
Yeah, I don't like to do that. And I win the Marie Kondo first showed up in my Twitter feed. I still haven't read her books or watched her or anything, but just her idea if it doesn't spark joy, you shouldn't have it taking up space. And I feel I've always had a bit of that.
So Koiray Sikra summarized that book as, all you need is a single smooth river rock that reminds you of your mother, which I thought was a good distillation of the wisdom of Kondo. Yeah, I was joking. I am a pack rat. I my latest clothing thing that I've become obsessed with, that I always think of as very Gibsonian, is Boro fabric, B-O-R-O, from Japan, which is scraps of what was once very hard to find indigo dyed fabric,
Was
expensive. They make rag, like rag collages or rag quilts that are then turned into clothing. It's very beautiful, and the old stuff's amazing.
I've seen that. A friend of mine in Copenhagen is teaching herself to do that.
Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous. Now, there are a bunch of questions in the Q&A that all sort of relate generally to, like, what book are you working on? What's going on with the TV show? What kind of audio books are coming out, and so on? Can you give us a kind of, a pre-orderer's rundown of the Gibson things that we should be putting markers down on?
Well, there's the book, which I am writing. And
does it have a title yet?
Yeah. You know, I thought for a while that I sort of had no choice but to call it Jackpot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But now, I don't know. I'm feeling that it will probably be something else. In any case, I'm happier with it not having a title. I usually can't. It's unusual for me to set, nowadays anyway, to settle on a title and then stay happy about it. It can get in the way of the book finding what book it actually wants to be if it has a title that's too much one thing or another. For me, at least, it doesn't work that way for for everyone. The Amazon series of the peripheral is actually in pre-production in London for sure. I'm not sure they yet know where the rural American parts are going to be shot. So, I mean, I'm in awe of the idea that anybody could be in pre-production with anything in London right now, but that the industry seems unfazed.
Yeah, my sister-in-law's a producer there, and they're still doing stuff, so.
Yeah. But I think that's it, really, at the moment. Those are the two things that seem most likely to happen. And then there's the usual motley crew of interesting options for things. Those are always best left unmentioned.
Yeah, fair enough. And then we're coming to time here, and I wanted to ask the question that CSPO raised, which is whether you see anything positive in terms of the futuristic kind of visions of the world, whether it's all dystopia or whether you see some source of hope on our horizon here.
Well, I don't know. I mean, people, I was an English major. I got a BA in English literature in exactly the time while I was being an undergrad at UBC and an honors major in English.
Hey, Bill, take your hand away from your mic. We're getting a lot of muffling here.
Okay. Sorry, I forgot that's where my mic was. So while I was an undergraduate and an English major, I started trying to write science fiction, and I was actually trying to write science fiction by the time I graduated, but I think that I'm not sure if during the writing of Neuromancer I had ever heard or even seen the word dystopia. I know it existed then because it existed initially as a very English major term. People simply didn't use it. So I didn't think of it as something I was doing. I didn't think of Neuromancer as a dystopia. And indeed, given the fact that in 1981, probably the most intelligent people I knew on the planet woke up every day and probably had with some passing thought of would this be or not be the day in which the world ended in assured mutual nuclear destruction. I mean, people my age lived through like 30 years of that, 20 years of that. It was a very weird thing. So when I wrote Neuromancer, I thought I was being way optimistic because the scenario there is that the United States and Russia try to do it, but they're shut down by multinational corporations, which is also not a very common phrase when Neuromancer was written. It wasn't something that just fell off anyone's lips. So I've never really seen Neuromancer, for instance, as dystopian, because I knew when I was writing it, and this was important to me when I was writing it, that there were people living in in cities and other places all over the world who would happily immigrate to the to the world of Neuromancer and probably have it easier.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I didn't see it as dystopian so much as naturalistic. And
You know, I spent the about 2 months before the lockdown, I started work on a novel that I'm almost done on that I call The Lost Cause. That's a post-Green New Deal environmental utopian novel. But the thing that makes it utopian is not that we're not undergoing wrenching climate change. Like, everything is still terrible. There's floods and plagues and fires. And it's mostly about reconciliation with white nationalist militias and what you do with the losers of a just revolution. But the thing that makes it utopian is that they're not pretending it's not happening. Like, they've devoted themselves, you know, for example, there's a sizable cohort in the world who've devoted themselves to a project of relocating every coastal city 20 kilometers inland over the next 300 years, right? Because they've risen to the occasion. So that the world is horrible, but their relationship to it is not surrender or denial, but confrontational, and they have a great work ahead.
That sounds great, actually. I think that's really the only way to... the only way to approach that now. But I would predict that it won't become a genre of its own.
I've been in correspondence with Stan Robinson about this, because his new Ministry for the Future is something like this as well, and it's trying to write. It's very easy, you know, the shibboleth that it's harder to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of capitalism. It's actually super easy to imagine life after capitalism. It's the part where we go from one to the other that's very hard to imagine.
Yeah. Indeed. Although it fascinates me that we might go to the end of capitalism without going to any of the places that people have historically wound up by attempting to go there. It might just happen.
Well, Bill, I think we're at our time here. I want to thank you for taking the time for this. I thought Agency was a corker of a novel. So looking forward to the next one. And, you know, it's been 22 years since we started having these conversations, and I learn stuff every time. So it's been a real treat.
Well, thank you so much, Corey. It's really good to see you. And this is also unmasked, you know?
Yeah. I have one here.
Actual faces.
Here we go. It's got a little metal clasp that stops my glasses fogging up. That's what makes it the good mask. I fight with my family because they take the good mask, and then we have to argue about it.
I know. You always have to get multiples.
Yeah.
For the good mask.
Thank you. Thank you, Corey, for moderating tonight, and thank you, William, for joining us to talk about Agency and everything within. Thank you, our audience, for joining us tonight. And if you haven't already purchased a copy of Agency, you may do so by clicking at the bottom button in the middle of your screen. And everyone, stay safe out there and have a good night.
Thank you very much. Yeah, give my regards to Broadway.